is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, March 24th, 2020. I'm Buster Olney, working in my home studio, and Taylor Schwenk is producing from his home studio. Taylor, how are you doing today?
Doing pretty well. You know, Buster, I actually failed to mention you before we got on. I had my, like, first, like, this sucks really hard day on Sunday. So I think I'm on the other side of that now, and I'm feeling optimistic. And I think it's working on the podcast with you. That's keeping the wind in my sails.
Yeah, I'm that way, too. It's funny because you definitely get moments when you're like, man, this is brutal. You know, you see the news and then you go about your day, right? Because you got work to do. You got things to do. I make a checklist for myself because I feel like that at times, like, that checklist, like, helps me get through a day.
Yeah, I've had definitely, like, my list of work things to do. And honestly, like, I've been, you know, I probably start getting the rundown together about 8 o'clock, and I'm working till almost 4 or 5 pretty straight through. And then I do a little workout, then it's time for dinner, and then the day is over. So actually the weekend was more brutal than the weekday has been, because then you just got nothing to do.
And you and your wife are probably getting fired up for another drive on Friday.
Oh,
right,
it's already been discussed. Don't you worry. It's in the works.
All right. For listeners, you know the name Ripken mostly because of Cal Jr. You'll hear today about where that toughness came from. Cal Sr. I don't want to give away all the stories we're going to hear from Bill Ripken as he talks to us about his book, but here is a 2-phrase hint: blood blister and power drill. Blood blister and power drill, right, Taylor?
Yeah, it was toward the end. It's almost like Ripken family movies is what you're kind of hearing, which was awesome, personally.
Before we get to that, some news and notes. The Pirates sent 400 pizzas to hospital workers in Pittsburgh. The pizzas plus helpings of pasta were delivered by Pirate staff members to his staff at Allegheny General Hospital. Pitcher Jameson Taillon told MajorLeagueBaseball.com that the single gesture accomplished 2 feats: aid to one of the Pittsburgh area businesses affected by the coronavirus pandemic and help to the hospital staff helping combat it. Aaron Boone told the Yes Network that Giancarlo Stanton is continuing to recover from his grade 1 strain of his right calf, and had opening day not been delayed, the Yankees would have expected the slugger to return early in the season. Boone said Giancarlo is doing great. If we were to start spring training games up tomorrow, he probably would be ready to go. Aaron Boone also had a message for fans on Twitter.
Hey, Yankee fans, Aaron Boone here. Miss seeing you guys. Miss seeing you guys out at GMS. Miss seeing you guys at Yankee Stadium. But now's the time. We've got to make sure we all do our part in these challenging times. Make sure you're taking care of loved ones, friends, and family. It's not going to be too long before I see you guys back out on the field. Can't wait for that day. In the meantime, let's just stay strong together. Take care.
And as we continue our storytelling, we're going to have Aaron Boone on the podcast later in the week. Before we get to Bill Ripken today, I want to note, during this time of social isolation, no games to watch, it's not just the Baseball Tonight podcast that's still churning out content for you. ESPN Podcast is adapting to this new normal and dropping new episodes of your favorite shows every day. Just yesterday, we had new editions of South Beach Sessions, Ariel Helwani's MMA show, Fantasy Focused Baseball, the F1 Podcast, and Hoop Collective. Find them all wherever you get your podcasts. Bill Ripken played 12 years in the big leagues. He's now an analyst for MLB Network. He's also the author of the new book, State of Play, the Old School Guide to New School Baseball. And Bill, if I made a list of the 10 funniest players that I covered, you would be on that list. How are you doing?
Well, I appreciate that. So to still maybe be in the top 10 with all the people that you've covered, I'm doing okay for myself.
Yeah, I knew that you'd wind up on TV because your knowledge of the game first and foremost, but also your sense of humor. What was your inspiration for writing the book?
Well, I think over the past few years, we've gotten so enamored with the conversation of the new school or the metrics or the analytics. And I think we've forgotten or lost sight of the fact that old school baseball guys like me have always used numbers, have always used information to come up with a plan. We've never just thrown the bats and balls out on the field and said, go get them. And I think there's this connotation out there that the old school guy just flew by the seat of his pants. And that's just not the case. It never has been. It never will be.
And one of the examples you cite, it doesn't surprise me, you go back to him, was your dad. Your brother, as you note in the book, you know, he's the Hall of Famer. He's the guy who's going to make the Ripken name go down in history. But your dad was a true baseball patriarch. And you talked about it, and this was fascinating to me, how after during the course of games and after every game, he was accumulating information. Yes.
Yeah. And that probably stemmed back way back in the day in the minor leagues, you know, when the Orioles used to be a model organization back in the day when Earl Weaver was in charge. There was his coaching staff was set, but there were some guys in the minor leagues that were charged with getting guys to the big leagues that would play the Oriole brand of baseball. So all the years Dad managed in the minor leagues, he'd watch the games, every pitch from the top step of the dugout when he managed. And from the offensive side, he was in the coaching box at third base coach, because that's what the managers did in the minor leagues. And he would make notes and write them down on his 3x5 index cards. He'd line them up on his desk for the next day. The guys would start filtering in. He'd find a player would walk in that would match up with one of his index cards. And he'd say, "You got a few minutes?" They'd sit down and they'd talk about how to make improvements, and you can't do that, or that was great job doing that. And it was the information that was at his hand. And I agree with more information. I'm okay with spreadsheets. I'm okay with all these new ideas, but I'm still convinced there's no substitute for a crusty old dude that watched every pitch of every game down in the minor leagues, that he is better equipped to make the determination if a guy's going to play in the big leagues or not.
What are some examples? And first off, did your dad ever present an index card to you about you?
He gave me one, and you were there in 1987, correct?
No, I covered you in 1996. I was covered the team in 95 and 96.
Okay, so you weren't the one of the very first ones that were in there. I get all you guys confused, because all you guys came up at one time. You and Timmy and Richard and Ken Rosenthal. I put you all in the same group. But anyway, he presented me one. If there was one thing I could do, I thought I could do pretty well, was catch the ball and throw the ball where I was supposed to. And I made an error in a game in 1987 where I went up the middle as a second baseman, kind of treated it not important. And I threw it a little bit wide at first base. And I came in from the field, and Senior was the manager, and he said, did you treat that out like it was important? And I tried to deflect and blame Eddie for not getting to the bag one time. And I said, well, he got there a little bit late, and I threw it towards him, and then it just didn't work out. And he stopped me like midstream, and he goes, did you treat that out like it was important? And I said, no. And he goes, don't ever do that again. And it put me in my place, but those were kind of the things that you would get from Senior. And I really believe from that was my first year in the big leagues in 87, that every ground ball hit to me, I treated it as very important. And if we do that as an infielder, if we treat every out like it's the last out of the game, even if it might be the third or the fourth, you're going to be better off for it.
Now, it's clear in reading the book, look, you are not bashing analysts, and you're not bashing information. As you just mentioned, you know, you like information. Some of the phrases and the use of some phrases clearly grate on you, which is why I use some of them as chapter titles. So I'm going to give you phrases, and then I want you to elaborate on what you're talking about. Pitch framing.
Well, pitch framing is interesting because this importance that is put on this catcher catching the ball and trying to steal strikes from umpires. And in theory, I get it. I understand that there are guys that catch the ball a little bit better than somebody else, but let's think about that. When a catcher catches the ball, it's 3 or 4 feet behind the strike zone, meaning it's already crossed the front edge of home plate. It's already crossed the front side of the hitter, which is either the knees or the waist to determine that. And if we're grading out pitchers for being able, or catchers for being able to steal strikes, I don't know how we can put all the onus on the catcher of being good or not. When I believe if you have Nolan Ryan on the mound, for example, back in my day, Nolan got the benefit of the doubt, although he didn't need it more than anybody else. So it doesn't matter how the catcher necessarily caught the ball. It was who was on the bump. If Wade Boggs was hitting, his strike zone was smaller than somebody else that wasn't as good as Wade Boggs. So there were so many other determining factors on why a pitch, in my opinion, is called a strike or a ball or not, and we're trying to measure everything in today's game, and the pitch framing thing just blows me away. What happens when we go to robo-ump? The 4 years of research that all the people that swear by pitch framing is being done is going to be thrown out of the window. I prefer a catcher that can block a ball in the dirt and keep a guy on third base way more than a guy that catches the ball a little bit better than maybe somebody else.
I totally agree with what you're saying about pitch framing. In fact, I, you know, went about 3-4 years ago, I went back and found common denominators with a lot of the guys who were leaders in the pitch framing metrics. For example, Jonathan Lucroy, you know, terrific major leaguer, veteran, been around a long time. When he was with the Milwaukee Brewers, he had tremendous pitch framing numbers. And then in recent years, when he's gone to other staffs, he hasn't. Well, those great pitch framing numbers, Bill, were when he was a teammate of Zach Greinke. I suspect that anybody who's catching Zach Greinke is going to look really good. The Astros catchers have always done really well in pitch framing numbers. But a lot of that was when Dallas Keuchel was there. On the other hand, in recent years, a lot of criticism, Matt Wieters, when he was with the Orioles, and I've talked to Matt about this. I think anybody who's a regular catcher for Yubaldo Jimenez probably not going to look that good in those pitch framing numbers.
No, you're right. And here's something, too, because what you just listed is very important. When you're talking about Zach Greinke, first of all, he has a reputation of always being around the plate. When you have that reputation, you're going to get more strikes called for you because you're the pitcher, not necessarily for the catcher. And in Matt Wieters' case, the numbers started going down when the Orioles started not winning games. And if you're Matt Wieters and you're catching in Yankee Stadium, and let's be honest with this, you're catching in Yankee Stadium and it's a close pitch on one of the Yankees that's at home plate in their ballpark in a key point and time of the game, the umpire calls that a ball more times than he's going to call it a strike, regardless of how Matt Wieters is going to catch it. So when you're playing the Boston Red Sox in Fenway, you're playing the New York Yankees in Yankee Stadium, and you're Matt Wieters catching, you're not going to get the benefit of the doubt on close pitches no matter how you catch it.
Now, I've got some others to ask you, but I want to double back on what you're talking about with the robo-ump. I don't think people really understand how dramatically that will change the game, and especially a position that has been right at the heart of baseball for so many years. You know, reason why so many former catchers became managers. From your experience in baseball, how much of a change will it be?
Well, I don't want it, one. In the chapter in my book, when I'm talking about the robo-ump slash, you know, ball strike umpires, I think there are umpires out there that are better than other guys at calling balls and strikes. And I think we do have a pretty decent amount of technology that can grade umpires. I'm not so sure what we do with that information once we have it. But I do know that the better umpires calling balls and strikes, you don't recognize near as many of those names as the guy that's on the bottom of the list of calling balls and strikes. So my idea is to find the best ball strike umpires, pay them more, and they umpire behind home plate. And if they have to bounce to second base the next day where they can kind of study from that angle, that's okay with me. But the worst umpires are the ones that don't call ball strikes very well. Don't call ball strikes anymore. They're first base and third base umpires, and they stay there with the help of instant replay. But if we have ball strike umpires that can actually be good, and then they can focus solely on that craft, that's my last ditch effort, because I think robo-ump's coming one day, and I think the umpires are going to do it to themselves. So if we have good ball strike umpires, and there are some in the game, let's find more of those guys and let's utilize them for their strengths and just call balls and strikes.
An example that, and I've heard this from players, I always heard Joe West was a terrific ball strike umpire. So why not let him umpire more games behind home plate, yes?
Well, if he grades out to be one of the better ones, we might have to do a little bit of analysis on other parts of his game. But
right.
The fact is, if we have guys that can call ball strikes, let's give them the responsibility of calling ball strikes and don't waste their talent by every fourth day they're behind home plate and then the other days they're on the bases. Let's get them behind home plate a little bit more, pay them a little bit more because of it's more of a challenging job. But I'm trying to fight this robo-ump as much as I can. I think that's the best thing that I can come up with so far.
Launch angle, what do you got?
Well, this one drives me crazy because it is conceived as the swing itself, and it's not. It's nothing more than the ball coming off the bat. It's exit angle. And if we would call it exit angle, maybe we would alleviate some of the misinterpretation that's out there. Any kid that goes into his backyard and hits off his dad has a launch angle. Babe Ruth had a launch angle. Launch angles existed forever, but now we have this clever little name for it, and we want to talk about it. The thing that drives me crazy on this, and I believe every network is guilty of this, we spend more time talking about the launch angle after somebody hits a home run than when, why was the pitch hit for a home run? What, did he hang a slider and the pitch right before it, he threw a fastball by the guy? That's the reason the ball went out of the ballpark. But we want to put the exit velocity, the distance, the launch angle all up on the screen and spend all kinds of time talking about that with pretty graphics than we do with why the pitch was actually hit out of the ballpark in the first place. It's interesting to note on launch angle. In 2018, Christian Yelich won the MVP with Milwaukee with a year-long average launch angle of 4.9. Mookie Betts won the American League MVP, average year-long launch angle of 18.4. There's no one-size-fits-all in the launch angle category. And for someone to say he improved his launch angle or he worked on his launch angle is the two sayings and phrases that drive me crazy the most. Javier Baez, 2016, 2017, 2018, got repeatedly better as an offensive player. And in 2018, his launch angle was 2 degrees lower than his 2016 launch angle was. So to say he improved his launch angle, does that mean it goes down? Because the connotation is, anytime you say improve, you mean it goes up. But there's no one size fits all. You catch a ball out in front a little bit more as a hitter. You hit it out of the ballpark. Yes, the launch angle is going to be somewhere around 18 or 20 or 25. That's a given nowadays. I don't think we need to spend as much time talking about it because it's, quite frankly, it's irrelevant to me. Everything that happens prior to contact is what should be talked about. The ball leaving the bat, to me, is a non-issue.
Yeah, I think the improvement in Javier Baez, and again, you know better than I do, was the fact that he began to take fastballs the opposite field more. I think that was probably more relevant, you know, in his improvement. And it does feel like that you do see hitters who almost are worsened by that phrase. In other words, that focus, Rougned Odor comes to mind. Like somebody, you could see the change in what he was doing. I think some players get so obsessed by it to the point of distraction.
Well, I think you're right. And I think there's part of that is we have to swing up in order to hit the ball up. I don't agree with that. A completely level swing with a round bat and a round ball can produce the 90-degree launch angle, which, by the way, is a pop-up to the catcher, a negative 90, which you're beating the ball off a home plate, or a line drive back at the pitcher, which would be a zero. A round ball and a round bat, both going on the same horizontal plane, can create every one of those things that I just talked about. So I'm not saying that an uppercut swing or a slight uppercut swing is not the answer. It very well may be. But there are guys out there in the game that still hit. There's a lot of games or a lot of guys in the game that still hit with that traditional kind of look and that traditional approach, in my opinion. And those are the ones that are pretty much better off for doing what they do.
Now, analysts would tell you that the defensive part of the game is the part where the numbers are lagging in terms of being able to capture what's happening. And you make it very clear, you are not buying DRS, defensive run saved.
I'm not. And if they're telling me that it's not perfect and it's still a work in progress, let's not introduce it yet. I understand the concept is to try to get rid of the old-fashioned error column. Well, I still believe in errors because I believe if you take care of the ball and you make less errors than the other team, the box scores year-long will tell you you win 60% of your games if you make less errors than the other team. If you win 60% of your games in a 162-game season, you win 100. And if you win 100, you go to the playoffs every single year. Look at the Cardinals and what Paul Goldschmidt did for them 1 year to the next. They led the league in errors 1 year. They were fewest errors the next year when Paul Goldschmidt showed up and they won the division. That should tell you pretty much a lot of things that you need to know. Now, the DRS, I understand why they're doing it, why they're trying it. DRS seemed to replace UZR. And now I've already noticed that OAA is being talked about more than DRS, which is outs above average. Three-letter things that all sound catchy doesn't necessarily mean that they're right, accurate, or anything else. So Matt Chapman, good defensive third baseman by the Oakland A's. Nolan Arenado, good defensive third baseman for the Colorado Rockies. In 2018, Chapman was listed, I believe, at 30 defensive runs saved for the year. Nolan Arenado was listed at 6. So those numbers are trying to tell me that Chapman's 5 times the defender as Nolan Arenado. Now, the number of people who love the DRS would say that's not what this is saying. Well, it's exactly what it's saying. If 30 is 5 times what 6 is, you're telling me he's 5 times better as a defender. And when you have something that glaring and you're trying to just throw almost darts at the board and you're putting one number to define somebody in some way, I'm just not buying into it.
We're talking to Bill Ripken, the author of the new book, State of Play, The Old School Guide to New School Baseball. How do you feel about wins above replacement? Because I like it. I think it's an imperfect attempt to sort of box up everything and to place a value on players. But I think we do have to, and everyone should recognize that it is imperfect.
It is imperfect. And once again, it's trying to put one solitary number on players. And I just think it's too hard to do. So one of my examples that I use on DRS and why I don't like it, one is the, not DRS, WAR. One is kind of the definition of itself, wins above replacement. And a replacement player from when it first came out was defined as a readily available AAA player or a bench player to take over somebody's duty. So in 2015, Jackie Bradley Jr. was sent down several times to Pawtucket, AAA. But yet at the end of the year, he had a 2.3 WAR, wins above replacement. He was the very player that they're talking about as a replacement. So he should be a wins above Jackie Bradley Jr. at 2.3 because he was the readily available AAA player on several occasions to come back to the big leagues and ultimately end up with a 2.3 WAR when I believe the definition initially started and a replacement player is valued at 0. So how can a wins above Jackie Bradley Jr. himself, how can he be a 2.3 player at the end of the year?
And another example you cite with that is Albert Pujols.
Correct. Albert in a lot of different ways. The metric people are not big fans of Albert. In fact, I believe he was listed as a WAR at one time. I believe someone actually said he might have been the worst offensive player or regular position player in the game. And I look at that and I got to scratch my head because, yes, I still believe in runs batted in. The old school thing, runs batted in. Is it somewhat dependent on other people? Sure it is, but so is everything else in the game. That's why it's a team game. But there are guys that can have established, they have a knack for driving in runs. And when Albert drives in 100 and some runs in a year, even when he's not Albert-like, and his wins above replacement is supposed to be a negative or flat even, I can't fathom a readily available AAA player coming into the big leagues and driving in 100 runs during a big league season. If they could do that, they would not be in AAA. They would not be a readily available AAA player. They'd be a big league player. So Albert, I think they look at everything. Okay, can he run anymore? No. But when you put him in the batter's box and there's men out there on base, he finds a way to drive people in. And the last I checked, you got to score runs to win games. And therefore, you must need guys who can drive in runs to score runs.
You know what? I agree with you. And I think that's based on, you know, years and years of conversations with hitters where they talk about, you know, that's what they're aiming to do. And a lot of players measure themselves by their ability to drive and run. So to say that it has no value, I'm just not buying that. Another one, I'm curious about how you feel about this, because I've heard this argument that there is no statistical evidence that lineup protection matters. And that makes my head explode because I'm like, of course it does. All you need to do, go talk to a catcher, go talk to a manager, go talk to the pitcher on the other side who literally from pitch to pitch is making decisions based on who's in the on deck circle, where guys, how many guys on base in front of them, and where they are in the lineup.
Well, the other thing with that too is it's not only who's behind them, but who's in front of them, because if you've got traffic on base all the time, that's almost a form of lineup protection as well. But you make an interesting point about that, because if the manager on the other team has the sign to the catcher, like an intentional walk or a pitch around, let's see if he'll chase early, and then we just waste pitches. But obviously, as a defensive ploy, the manager of the other side is okay with maybe walking a guy, which jumps into the average versus on base percentage thing, which is another chapter in the book that I feel pretty strongly about. But lineup construction or lineup configuration to me blows me away, because I think that Christian Yelich, I think that Mike Trout are wasted in hitting in the two hole. And I believe the theory on why they do that is it gets them extra plate appearances during the course of the year, hitting one spot closer to number one. Well, that lineup protection or that lineup configuration, that gets them 15 to 20 plate appearances extra on the course of the year if they hit second or if they hit third. But if you hit third, you're getting a 57% chance. If you have two guys in front of you that can just get on base at a 350 clip, you get a 57% chance of hitting in the first inning alone with at least one guy on base. So 57% of 162, obviously 81 is 50%. So let's say 85 plate appearances in the first inning alone, you have a chance to hit with runners on base. If you score first, you win about 65% of your games. It makes sense to me if the best way to score first is score in the first inning. So if I got a guy that can hit me 40 homers and hit a bunch of doubles as well, I kind of want the guys on base in the first inning alone than that extra 15 or 20 plate appearances over the course of the entire season.
All right. It's a fascinating read. Again, the name of the book is State of Play. I really enjoyed it. Before you go, I got some quick hitters for you. I wanted to ask you about who's the best defensive player you've ever seen.
Best defensive player I've ever seen. Wow, that's a tough one. I mean, I got to give my brother credit for an awful lot of stuff. And when I watched him play, there was nothing that he didn't do on a daily basis that amazed me sometimes. And that even includes in the field. At 6'4" and a half, 225 pounds, he did some things at short that was pretty cool. And the fact that he went an entire season, and of course we know he played 162 in that entire season, and only made three errors, whether you think it's an old-fashioned stat or not, in the course of the entire season was pretty darn good. So I would have to kind of throw a little bit that way. And then I'm going to go a little twist, and I'm going to talk about Pudge Rodriguez. Because when I played with Pudge in Texas, Pudge not only could throw out people, we understood that. But what he did was no one got secondary leads when they were on bases. So the guy at first base was scared to death of getting too far off first because he was going to get picked off. Therefore, they didn't go first and third on a base hit to right. Therefore, they didn't get down on you and break up a double play because they weren't getting big secondary leads to get off the base. So not only did people not start running on Texas and Pudge, they didn't go first to third and they didn't break up double plays at the same time. So his one attribute of that arm that was unbelievably good, and his feet were unbelievably quick, he changed the dynamics of the other team. And I think when you're talking about overall team or overall defense, I think you have to put him in the conversation because he changed how the other teams played against you.
You just made my case for Yadier Molina for the Hall of Fame, because I think the next closest number of attempts of stolen bases against a team is like 1,000 more than where the St. Louis Cardinals have been since Yadi took over as their catcher for the exactly what you're talking about. The best teammate you ever had?
Well, Junior's in the mix again because he's my brother, and I don't think everybody can say that they had the chance to play with their brother in the big leagues, and that was a lot of fun. Enjoyed my time down in Texas. Instantly met some people down there that I really liked. Dean Palmer jumps up, Bobby Witt jumps up, Gary Reedus jumps up, as far as guys that I played with. And there were a lot of them. There's no question about that. But when I think about the things, the three names that always come up when I went to Texas right away was Gary Reedus, Dean Palmer, and Bobby Witt, and Junior's still in there as well.
I wanted to ask you about, because you mentioned your brother, a lot of other players who played with him told me that they thought he had special healing powers, and they saw examples of that through the year. Give me some examples of that you saw.
Well, always as a kid, he was different. So when we grew up, if we were playing hoops in the driveway, I mean, he would get mad at anybody playing that just didn't want to play anymore. And he just wanted to keep going. I mean, I wanted to go down in the house and eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, take a nap. I was tired. And he never wanted to stop playing. And all the years that he played basketball in his gym for his off-season conditioning, and he was allowed to do that, the finger got jammed. You'd hear it pop. You'd look at it. It's all crooked. In fact, if you look at his pinky today, it kind of sticks out straight to the right. Roll an ankle. You'd hear it pop. And next thing you know, he's back out there on the next game. Like, he walks it off and you're going, dude, just go out there and chill, put ice on it. But he wasn't wired that way. So there was always this little something different about him, his drive, which is probably part of it. The fact that Senior raised him, and I believe when Dad was trying to plow the neighborhood streets and start up an old farm tractor and pull a V-plow behind the farm tractor, Pop said the farm tractor that he was trying to start with the old hand cranks, and those things are heavy, it slipped off when he was trying to do it, and it hit him right in the forehead and cut himself wide open. And Junior sitting there as a 16-year-old watching this, Senior went back to the house. And he always had his greasy rag in his back pocket that he was stopping the bleeding with, put some butterflies on it, went back up to the farm tractor, started the farm tractor, and then plowed the neighborhood. So I think when Junior was the oldest boy and he was around Senior in times like that, he goes, well, how can I tell him that I rolled an ankle when I just watched my man hit himself in the forehead with about a 10-pound crank and he's still standing, and he bandages himself up and goes back to work.
And there's also a story about him with a hand drill, right? And his big toe, if I remember correctly.
That is correct. Whenever you bruise your toenail bad enough where it starts to discolor and it's painful because it's filling up with blood, Dad would take the drill out and put a small drill bit in it, go to the bathroom, put his foot up on the toilet, you know, have a paper, a towel underneath his foot, and he'd just go ahead and drill his toe out. And the blood would squirt out, and he'd kind of stop it up, pain gone. So whenever we complained, we never did that as kids with him. We certainly had our bruised toenails, and we complain about them, and he'd say, well, I can fix that. And we go, no, we ain't doing that. And he'd go, well, then stop complaining. And you kind of stop complaining right there because you don't want that drill hitting your toe.
And last one for you, the thing that surprised me, because I covered your brother the year that he broke Lou Gehrig's record. And you're not anticipating when you walk in that you're always seeing Cal Ripken in a wrestling match with teammates all the time. It seemed like he was always wrestling somebody. Did you ever wrestle with him?
No, I told him I ain't playing that. Stop. And that was enough when we were kids, we did that. So I kind of learned in a long time ago, I'm not doing that. But I think better the stories, and you saw it at the big league level, the boys in the minor leagues, when they room with him, you ask John Shelby, Victor Rodriguez, who's now the assistant hitting coach for Cleveland. I was out there in spring training talking with Sandy Alomar, and I talked to Victor a little bit. In the minor leagues, when it was getaway day, so all the rooms that you had, if you had 20 rooms or 15 rooms, whatever it was for all the players, on getaway day, you condensed it to two rooms. Everybody loaded up their luggage and went into two rooms. That was the late checkout rooms. And Victor said he would hate every time they saw that Cal's room was one of the rooms that everybody was going into, because then he had more people in there in the minor league hotels, if you will. And he said it was kind of a free-for-all. So Victor said he hated every time he saw that Junior's room was one of them that got condensed to. But he liked his physical confrontations during the year for sure.
Did you ever see him lose one of those? Because I never did.
No. I really haven't. And when he put that knuckle in your ribs, he could make people squeal like a pig.
All right, Bill. Well, I appreciate it. Again, I really enjoyed the book. Thanks for taking the time.
I appreciate you. You have a good one now.
Bleacher Tweets.
All righty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Tuesday. First up, Portland Maverick at the Battered Bees writes in, after listening to the excellent interview with Dave Roberts, I thought about the lost art of the stolen base. Analytics may suggest not to do it, but it can't measure the disruption it causes plus the help it can provide a hitter. Thoughts?
I agree with you. I do think as we move forward, you're going to see more efforts made by Major League Baseball to help the running game. You guys have heard about the, you know, the proposed rule that they're going to use in the minor leagues this year, where left-handed pitchers are going to be required, like right-handed pitchers, to step off the rubber before throwing to first base. You know, for years, it's always been fine for a left-handed pitcher like an Andy Pettit, a Jimmy Key, to keep contact with the rubber as they make their delivery, and they also have the option of throwing to first base. That's not going to be the case anymore. And the thought is that that's going to help the running game. It'll increase action. I think you'll see baseball do a lot of things in an effort to make that happen.
Last one for today. We're going to go to Kyle Benning again, at Kyle_Benning. He writes in, Buster, the great discussion on the most important stolen bases of all time on Monday's episode made me wonder about other critical baseball plays in history. What about the most important double play ever, the most important bunt of all time, most important outfield assist, anything like that come to mind for you?
Kyle, great minds think alike, because we're actually thinking about a series for that on ESPN.com, and I'll have more information about that as we move forward. But yeah, we're going to be doing that episode yesterday about the greatest, the most important stolen base of all time. Actually, was that spark into the series that we're going to be doing going forward.
Alrighty, that does it for Bleacher Tweets. Please subscribe, rate, and definitely give us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Couple things to know before we get out of here on my end. If you're not current with the podcast, again, check out yesterday's episode. We had a phenomenal interview with Dave Roberts, manager of the Dodgers, sparked that 0-3 comeback in the ALCS in 2004, which we determined yesterday was the most important stolen base ever. Coming up this week, let's get your juices flowing a little bit, because we're going to have Shane Victorino. That's tomorrow on Wednesday. Thursday, we will have the greatest baseball story you've ever heard. That is going to be a lot of fun. Buster has not even really revealed that to me, so I'm excited for it. And then Friday, as previously mentioned, Yankees manager Aaron Boone. So how about that for a bookend to the weekend? And one last thing, everyone, I just want to point out, you know, with all the guests that we're having on, let's be real here. No one has a Rolodex fatter than Buster. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say no other baseball podcast right now has better guests than the Baseball Tonight podcast. Not a single one. So because of that, because we're all housebound, I want to appeal to you, make a suggestion to you. Tell a family member or friend who has not heard about the show, may not even know what a podcast is, with one of the interviews they might like on here. So I'll give my own personal story. I married into a family full of Yankees fans. But, you know, they I sent around that David Wells interview, and they loved it. They ate it up. My father-in-law, my brothers-in-laws, they were over the moon about it. My 96-year-old, grandfather-in-law, he of course has no idea what the podcast is, but he loved the interview. So, here's your chance, listeners. Share the podcast, share the gift of entertainment during these trying times. And basically that makes you a hero in my book. So, you know, share it around. We got great interviews coming. Buster gave me a sneak peek of guys he's trying to wrangle for next week, and I'm really excited about it. So give us a share to your own personal network.
And I'm not kidding. I'm going to continue to say the story we're going to have in the podcast on Thursday is the greatest baseball story ever. It's the most fun I've ever had working on a story. And the person who's going to join us is a great storyteller. So I'm really looking forward to that interview. That's it for today. My thanks to Bill Ripken and Taylor Schwenk. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.